and welcome to a special live episode of The Cinephiles here on The Cinephiles YouTube channel. I am one half of The Cinephiles, John Rocha, joined as always by my other half there, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing very well, and I'm not happy about the reason, but I'm thrilled to celebrate the life of one of the great artists we've ever known, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. We are going to be talking about James Earl Jones, who we just recently lost earlier this week, 93 years old. They haven't specified what the causes are, but he was a gentleman who suffered with type 2 diabetes for decades in his life. And I'm sure 93, you eventually kind of hit that wall. But hell of a life, Steve, 93, especially as a man of some size and some, you know, a lot of people don't survive that long who carry that weight. But clearly there was a strength and a power to this man beyond the physical realm that we can even remotely quantify, to be honest with you. But we're going to do our best as we talk about it here live on the show. Thanks to everybody who's joining us ahead of time. Of course, the Streamlabs and Super Chats are open. So if any of you want to send in your questions, thoughts, and memories, you can do so. The Streamlabs address is right there in the middle of the picture there on the graphic right above our heads. It also pinned in the chat here as we go along and in the description. So, but Steve, let's talk about this. We spent the whole time talking about this. What are your thoughts when you, and we've had a few days to process it. We've been doing these new special intros for these James Earl Jones films that we covered here on the Cinephiles for the last few years. So now that you've had a few days to process it, now that you've seen all the tributes, and now that you've kind of watched some stuff, sat with the memory of James Earl Jones, what are your feelings and thoughts about this incredible actor and man?
Well, I think they really solidified when you sent me that, you know, 16-minute YouTube, bunch of clips of his, which I just thought was so well done, because what that brought home, and we've posted it out on our social media, is what it really focused on was the human, was this person. And what it really brought home to me was, like, what a great spirit he was.
Yeah.
You know, like, his range as an actor was incredible. His kindness was sort of undeniable in the way he spoke about things.
Yeah.
He was so humble, you know, like he had such the spirit, what I will call the spirit of the actor in a way. There's one clip that was in that piece that you sent me.
Yeah.
It was an interview where someone was saying, well, do you want to speak out? Like, do you want to? And he said, no, that's not what I do. Like I'm here to give voice to these characters. And the best way for me to speak out is to make audiences feel what these characters are going through and their human experience, not for me to speak on my own. And I was like, so moved by that and by the beauty of just like, this is a guy who did this craft and his craft had value and he understood how to do it. And he understood how to do it from the beginning of the career to his end of the career. And he understood how to do it as Darth Vader, as Mufasa, as King Joffrey, as Tulsa Doom, in Field of Dreams as Terrence Mann. And those are, I mean, it's like, you know, we talk about actors with a tremendous range. James Earl Jones was always James Earl Jones. Yeah. And he was also able to portray in all these different genres and all these different styles, all these humans, and make them all completely real to us. I mean, there's nobody like him. No one like him.
No, I agree. And the outpouring of love and affect, at a time when we're so fractured, when we're so split and destroyed, it seems like this is a universally beloved person, right? And the way you see that is that where the tributes are coming from all over the spectrum and the affection and the love for him and what he was able to create. And you referenced that quote, and it was from the interview with Charlie Rose that he did years ago. And he, you know, they asked him, like, would you go out and speak in public and why don't you do more activist stuff? And he was aware of this. And he said, like, I can't do this. I can't do what other people can do, you know, with any of the activists who go out there and lead these protests. I have to do it through my work, because he couldn't handle talking in front of large people, even though he could be in a play and he could be in film. He couldn't handle that kind of back and forth or being out there. And he knew that about himself. So his work is where he spoke. His work is where his points of views were coming across. And look, we talk about the big, well-known films that he did, but you'd do him a disservice to not go and explore a lot of the topics that he, or a lot of the characters that he played in these lesser-known films, in these smaller films that reflect the Black experience in our country. A great white hope is really, there's one Steve and I have been talking about for the last few days, but that is a massive, massive film in James Earl Jones's career. If you want to get to know the young black man, the strength of this man and what he was trying to say with his work. He said it numerous times in that piece and other pieces, like he never got caught up in being like, I'm doing this for the black race. It was more about I'm doing this to reflect the actual society and the existence of what we go through. And so I think this was a fascinating approach to it, and an intelligent approach to it, Steve. And I think that's what radiates through a lot of his work, is there's a massive amount of intelligence involved here. And it may be because for a majority of his young life, he had that stutter. He shrank into himself. He had to observe the world, and then became a writer in high school. And it was his poetry teacher in high school who encouraged him to read his poems out loud, to read in front of people, to act them out, to bring them life. And that's who we really have to thank for motivating him to pursue a career in the arts, because that's where it begins. The little seed is planted that he could do this, which he does later on after he leaves the military. But that's the fascinating thing. The fact that he pulled back, he was able to observe. So his intelligence is what came to the forefront. And that intelligence is what we see in his performances and his his specifically selected roles that he did at certain times in his life to make commentary on what's going on for Black Americans in our society.
So it's fine. This analogy is going to sound totally bizarre, but I promise you I'm going to bring it together, which is I was just listening to a podcast from the National Constitution Center where they're interviewing a guy who just done a book about the presidency and about various presidents. And one of the things they talked about was that FDR was widely considered to be a fairly insubstantial person before polio. Is that before polio, he was, you know, a rich kid and well-educated, but not the top of his class. Nobody expected a lot from him. And dealing with that disease is what deepened him and created the strength and the resiliency and the sympathy and the humanity that allowed him to become a great president. And we've seen this with Martin Scorsese, who was a sickly kid. Francis Ford Coppola was a sickly kid. And I really think we can put James Earl Jones in this category of someone whose trauma as a young man shaped his humanity.
Yeah.
Both shaped him as an artist. Like you go, okay, here we're going to take someone who will become one of the great voices in the world of the theater, in the world of cinema.
Yes.
And their origin story is they had no voice.
You know? Right.
I mean, like that is like, I think, I mean, the value every word he speaks must have for him.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't speak. And the value, as you said so beautifully, like it's poetry that gave him his voice again.
Yeah.
That's where it came from. And so I just think that origin story is so profound to me.
Yeah. I mean, this is when you look at what he experienced at a young age, because I mean, we just recently did The Sting, which starred James Earl Jones's father, but he did not have a relationship with his father for a majority of his life, early life, until the 1950s, after he had already established himself and where he was going. But he, at 6 years old, he was born in a shack in Mississippi. And at 6 years old is where he's brought to his grandparents' home with his mom, and his dad leaves and his mom leaves, and his grandparents adopt him and raise him. And he said that's where the stutter came, because he said this in his biography, that was the end of my childhood at 6 years old. And so I was thrust into a whole nother environment. This, what I thought I'd seen as my loving, caring parents, although it was a tough upbringing with them because of the different motivations they each had in their lives, being pawned off on my grandparents and who wanted to raise me. What I had to experience there is what sent me into the shell and developed my stutter, because I felt ashamed of who I was. And I felt ashamed that I was thrown out by my parents. And so that is powerful, powerful stuff, to think that something like that could have stopped us from enjoying the greatness of James Earl Jones for decades to come. But the fact that he was able to climb out of it and do what he needed to do, I think speaks volumes to a lot of people who experience this kind of stuff at a young age, Steve. We're becoming more and more aware of it, of what kids experience and what adults now talk about that they experience as kids when in a society that wasn't aware of this stuff and how to deal with this stuff, you know?
I mean, as a parent, you spend so much time going, how do I protect my kid from trauma?
Yeah.
And I and of course we should. We shouldn't be like steering our kids towards trauma. Right. But I think the more important thing is to have the understanding that we're all going to go through trauma.
Yeah.
And that it's really what you do with it. You know, mm-hmm. like we can't protect people from all the terrible things that are going to happen to them in their lives.
Yeah.
What we hopefully can do is give them the skills. And like that teacher that came along for James Earl Jones, help guide them through what's yeah. hard, those hard times in our lives.
Well, but I also think, and this is maybe a bit, I don't want to get too pushy at the beginning of our tribute here, but I also think this is a commentary to be made. You can't just sit in your feelings being ashamed of this or that. Like, someone has to come along to believe in you and to motivate you to do it. We have to stop with the porcelain doll situation. There is a little bit of push that needs to be done along with respecting a situation, but there are possibilities. And so the fact that he was pushed, I think, is an essential part of this whole situation, because he might not have been pushed if there wasn't a teacher who believed in him and took a chance to push him out of his comfort zone to see what he could do. I'm not saying that works for everybody, but certainly it did in this situation.
Well, we're not all going to become James Earl Jones, but we all can have that moment where we have that great teacher come along.
Yes.
Where we have that person who sees something in us and that helps us get to the next spot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, go ahead, Steve. Yeah.
No, I was literally just clearing my throat because I had something stuck there.
Okay. But yeah, this is, I mean, so let me, I just want to give this the proper weight, because there was a fantastic write-up in mlive.com on James Earl Jones talking about his situation here. And I said, and the name of his autobiography is Voices and Silences, which is such a great title for his autobiography. And he said the move from Mississippi to Michigan, because that's where he ended up living with his grandparents on a farm, was supposed to be a glorious event. For me, it was heartbreak, and not long after that, I began to stutter. And it wasn't until one of his high school teachers, as I said here, Donald Crouch, learned that he learned that James could write poetry and demanded that Jones read one of his poems aloud in the class. And that's what started everything. He said, from that point over, it was a floodgate. I could not get enough of speaking, debating, orating, and acting. And then he went on to attend the University of Michigan, where he failed a pre-med exam, which is what led him to choose drama, to pursue drama there at the University of Michigan. By the way, he was a Wolverine. He played for 4 years on the basketball team.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. And then later, he went back to the University of Michigan to voice over the We Are Michigan video. And if you guys haven't seen that, you can find that on Twitter or on YouTube probably. It is incredible. He should voice over every college entrance, for God's sakes. But yeah, he graduated in 1955 with a Bachelor of Arts with a major in drama, served in the Army from 1953 to 1955, retired as a lieutenant, I believe, and then began his acting career. And this was during the Korean War, by the way, and then began his acting career at the Ramsdale Theater in Manistee to pay for his acting. He was a janitor along with learning these classes. So this was learning acting in these classes. So this was his life. There was no, like, you know, people just didn't give him money. Like, he had to work hard to start out as an actor here in the 1950s as a black man in this society of acting. So it's just fascinating. And went on, of course, to he won 2 Emmys, a Golden Globe, 2 Tony Awards, a Grammy, a National Medal of Arts, a Kennedy Center Honors, and was given an honorary Oscar and a special Tony for lifetime achievement. So he is a EGOT by the technical term overall. So just a fantastic legacy for what he was able to do and turn his life around. And Steve, we're discovering as we do the Cinephiles, how many people, we just start talking about the verdict, finding out Jack Warden's military service. It's amazing how many of these guys served in the military in some theater of war or during some time when war was happening, and then found their way to acting and really kind of flourished and became successful at it.
I mean, you've already informed me of all sorts of things I didn't know about the guy. And I was just thinking, by the way, the thought that just popped in my mind, are there any other voices other than James Earl Jones and Orson Welles who are at that level? Like, might not. I mean, there's like Charlton Heston has a great voice. I mean, there are a few other people who have great voices, but I don't think there's anyone else other than Orson and James Earl Jones that are that iconic.
That's an excellent point. maybe Richard Attenborough in a different way, right? Because of the nature documentary.
Well, he's a great narrator. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I don't know that there is like... Maybe
Don LaFontaine, who did the trailers for years.
Sure.
I think that's another one of those voices. But yeah,
yeah.
You can fit it in your hand, how many voices there are on the level of iconic as James Earl Jones's voice was. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is what he does as he comes out of, comes into his own as an actor here. He made his Broadway debut in 1957 with Sunrise at Campobello. So funny you bring up FDR. He originated the role, I think, of the butler or the footman there in Sunrise at Campobello, then gained prominence for acting in numerous productions at Shakespeare in the Park, Othello, Hamlet, Coriolanus, and King Lear. And then got it, then in 1968, The Great White Hope comes in as a play. He plays the character of Jack Johnson, essentially Jack Johnson there, and wins a Tony Award for that performance, then goes and does it and gets nominated for a Best Actor Award in 1970 for the film version of that, and then got another Tony Award in 1987 for Fences, for playing the father in Fences. He was also nominated for On Golden Pond in 2005, and got nominated in 2012 in Gore Vidal's play The Best Man, playing a former president. So fascinating characters to play. But he was also in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Driving Miss Daisy, You Can't Take It With You, The Gin Game. And as you mentioned in one of our intros, but his film debut is Dr. Strangelove. And the way he got Dr. Strangelove is that Stanley Kubrick came to see King Lear. It was King Lear. And then James Earl Jones. He was going to see George C. Scott in King Lear, then saw James Earl Jones and cast James Earl Jones off of seeing him, even though he was there to see George C. Scott. So that's how he got into Dr. Strangelove, Steve. So an interesting way to get in there.
Well, I mean, I know that his theater work, I also know because when we did, I think, Hunt for Red October, it's because John McTiernan had seen him in Fences with Courtney Vance,
right,
which is why both of them are in Hunt for Red October. So obviously his theater work brought on a lot of his film work. Yeah. And John, I have many, many things to say right now, and I would like to ask you, which direction would you like to go?
Wherever you want to
talk Great White Hope?
Whatever you want, and I want to clarify one thing. It wasn't King Lear. It was The Merchant of Venice. Ah. George C. Scott was playing Shylock, and James Earl Jones was playing the Prince of Morocco.
Gotcha.
Later, he does a fantastic. If you want to watch him do his Shakespeare stuff, there's a phenomenal monologue he did at the White House from Othello, when Othello is pleading his case to all the senators there. And that monologue, when he delivers it, is incredible. All right. Just wanted to clarify that. So, Steve, where do you want to go?
Well, I will say first, just I think Dr. Strangelove, it's not an important James Earl Jones performance. It's not an amazing James Earl Jones performance. He's totally 100% good, but it is one of the great Easter egg performances. You know what I mean? It's like Richard Dreyfuss showing up in The Graduate, where you just go, oh, there he is.
Yes.
Which is really fun. So I just watched Great White Hope again. Okay. I got to talk about that.
Yeah.
First of all, I cannot tell you how fucking angry I am that that movie does not exist anywhere on any of the major streaming services. I had to watch a very average version that's on YouTube that obviously someone just ripped off a DVD. And I'm like, this is one of the great films.
Yeah.
And if people have, and if you are out there and you are a James Earl Jones fan and you have not seen this movie, you actually don't know James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a whole... Because we see most of the movies are mature James Earl Jones.
Right.
They're James Earl Jones has been around for a while. And it's also most of the films, not the theater, obviously, but most of the films, he's not the lead. Yeah. You know, like he's playing a fantastic supporting actor in Field of Dreams or Coming to America or wherever else you see him. And he's always great.
Yeah.
Here he's the lead. And not only is he the lead, but he's a young man. And he is in the seething, angry, layered, complicated, self-hating, proud, arrogant, striding, violent, you know, restrained person that he plays in this role is unlike anything you've ever seen this actor do. And it is one of the great performances, bar none.
I've been telling Steve about this film for years. I've been telling people about
this film. You haven't telling me. I've seen it. I've seen it many. This wasn't the first time I saw it.
Okay. I was telling people about this film for years and telling people this is the James Earl Jones. So I echo everything Steve Morris is saying, because this is a film that I saw as a 17-year-old, sick home from school. I rented that film, and this was what when James Earl Jones came to be. Now, I enjoyed him in Conan, and I thought he was great as Thulsa Doom. Well, he's playing a villain in Thulsa Doom, right? It's fun in Conan. Schwarzenegger is why I watch Conan, even though James is great. I obviously knew Star Wars because of Vader and all. I knew his voice. But yes, what Steve is saying, right, the great white hope is when you really see who this man is as an actor and see his powerful blackness come through in this performance. It's heartbreaking. It's devastating. It's a commentary on race in our society through the prism of what Jack Johnson experienced. Obviously, it's based on a true story type of approach.
Yeah, it's fictionalized. So
it's fictionalized in its approach, but the basic points of what happened in that movie are what happened to Jack Johnson. And so to see how he could portray that character with such power, I don't think we ever see a performance from James Earl Jones on film again that rivals what he does in this movie, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think I first saw it. It's funny that we're doing The Verdict right now, which is our movie that's coming out next week. And because my feeling is, I think I first saw Great White Hope around the same time, is that I saw it maybe I was 13 or 14. I definitely had already seen Rocky, you know, and I remember this is a movie I watched many, many times in like high school and college. I mean, it was this is a transformative film for me, you know. And then, of course, watching the great Ken Burns documentary, I've kind of gone back and forth. And I texted you. I was like, I think I got to watch Jack Johnson, The Unforgivable Blackness, which is a fantastic documentary again, because it's one of those. I mean, the real person, Jack Johnson, is not only one of the most important figures in sports history, but he's also one of the most important figures in American history.
Yeah.
His story is absolutely fascinating. And the portrayal and the tragedy. I mean, we were talking before our last recording about when James Earl Jones smiles in this movie, and you can see the rage underneath that smile.
Yep.
And you can see him being what the white society wants him to do and hating it. And the other thing that's fascinating about the fucking movie is there's also pressure on him from the African-American community to be something that he doesn't want to be. And you can see his anger there. There's this whole world trying to control this guy. Yeah. And this guy is more powerful, more charismatic, more brilliant than anybody else around him.
Yeah.
And yet he is basically has to fight the whole world, you know?
Yeah. Which is why I think it's an important film to watch to understand the time period, not only where the film is set, but when the film was made. You know, 1970, just coming out of the civil rights. Of course, the play was written or debuted in 1968. So right in the knee deep in the civil rights movement at that time, what was going on. And I think it's a brilliant film that speaks to not only just the black experience in this country with white people, as you just highlighted, it also speaks to the black experience with other black people. And we see that nowadays. How there's pressures on all black artists to cater to the black community and not sell out too much to the white community, because then you're betraying the black community. So there's so much within that film that is a commentary not only on white people, but also on black people. And I don't think it's a coincidence that at the end of the movie, it's a young black kid who spits on him. And that's the commentary, right? And so I think there is so much in that film that actually shows you, yes, he went through a lot of racist stuff, but also within his own community, there was a rejection because he became so famous. And that's what we see in a lot of communities of color. If you become so famous that you appeal to white people, there are people who say you're betraying your color by becoming so popular in that way. And so I think it's a fascinating film as a first entry point into James Earl Jones. There are other films you can watch as we're going to talk about and highlight, but that's the film you need to watch to understand who James Earl Jones is as an actor, because you're going to be hard pressed to find any full complete copies of his performances on stage to see what he was like on stage. I think this is the closest thing you'll get to it. And, you know, Jane Alexander, who played his wife in the movie, she spoke about the fact that she thinks the film wasn't quite as successful as it should have been because it's such a straight adaptation of the play that it didn't kind of walk its own path. So you're essentially watching the play when you're watching this movie, essentially. So it's the closest you'll get to watching him on stage, I think, in any film that he's ever done.
Well, so speaking of which, yeah. I guess this is the perfect time to say that there are really two great theatrical experiences in my life that are head and shoulders above everything else. Mm-hmm. One was seeing a production of American Buffalo at Berkeley Rep when I was in high school. Yeah. And that was the moment, because I'd always been a theater kid. I'd acted in plays since I was in first grade. I had always done a lot of theater, and it was sort of in high school that I was going, okay, I'm gonna stop doing this kind of thing. I'm gonna become a lawyer, and I'm gonna do those things. And then I went to see this production of American Buffalo, and mm-hmm. I'd never seen anything like that before. And it was like one of the most profound theatrical experiences I ever saw.
Yeah.
And the second one was seeing James Earl Jones in Fences my sophomore year in college.
Where did you see that?
It was at the Touring Company in San Francisco. So it was, I think, at the Curran Theater. And there was to say that my head was blown back mm-hmm. by the power of this performance. It was one of the most remarkable. I mean, honestly, every August Wilson play I've ever seen has been one of the great experiences in the theater I've ever had. Sure. I mean, every one of those plays are just like, and I think there's a strong argument to be made that August Wilson, in fact, is the greatest American playwright. I mean, I really think.
Wow.
There's no weakness in any of those plays that I've ever, I don't think I've seen the entire cycle. Mm-hmm. I've seen most of them, but like, you know, between Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and Nat Turner Come and Gone and all those, I mean, there's just amazing, amazing plays, but Fences was the top. And I would now like to reveal an embarrassing, an unbelievably embarrassing story, but I'm going to tell it now because it illustrates just how much I love James Earl Jones.
Okay.
Which is, and it's really stupid. It's not quite as stupid as like me saying like I did blackface at some point. It's not that. But after seeing Fences for my next audition, maybe sophomore year in college,
yeah,
there was no play I loved more. So I did a monologue from Fences. And because I had seen James Earl Jones, I just thought, because I didn't understand what acting actually was, that I was like, well, I'll just do an impression of James Earl Jones. And so I did a James Earl Jones voice doing this monologue from Fences, and nobody fucking came up to me and said, hey, Steve, you're a nice white Jewish kid from the suburbs. You shouldn't be doing a voice like that. That's not, you can't do that. Nobody told me, but it was just because I loved this performance so much.
Sure.
And I was so moved by it. And I was like, I want to be that, you know? Right. And so I just went and did it like I was James Earl Jones. And it's embarrassing now, but it's also like, this is how much I've never been in a theater and had an experience like I had watching him do his work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, there's a clip of it online of the scene with him and Courtney B. Vance where he says, you know, nothing says I gotta like you, you know. And if you haven't watched the clip, I would encourage anybody who's watching us now or listening to us now to watch that clip on YouTube and see the back and forth between the two of them. Look, Denzel Washington's performance was fine. That was a fine movie, but it ain't James Earl Jones. And what he does in that scene, when you watch it, the body movements, the way he slaps his chest, the things he says, the rhythm and the pacing of his I'm starting to think that you're like Sinatra singing Old Man River doing that monologue. And totally. So you see the way he does it and the way he portrays it. I was watching it again, Stephen. I can't fault you for what you did, because I'm watching that and all I am is jealous that I'll never be able to do that monologue or that play or that character on stage quite in that way. But it made me think that doing it through a Latino point of view, whatever the Spanish word is for Fences, rajas, it could be really interesting, because there are similarities in how some Latino immigrants grow up in this country, certainly for related to my father, and what they have to do in order to provide for their sons. And they may not have the emotional bandwidth to be able to connect with their sons. So there's a lot in Fences that appeals to anybody who's got father-son dynamics, which, by the way, Field of Dreams, father-son dynamics there as well. Sure. Lion King, father-son dynamics there. Well, I don't think there's a coincidence that a lot of the things that he was involved in kind of relate back to his own relationship with his father, and these things that he's maybe navigating or exploring or processing himself as he plays these roles in these venues. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and you know, you got to add Darth Vader and Coming to America. They've got more father figures. I mean, frankly, to some degree, he is a father figure to all of us. I mean, you can't look at that man and not feel like this, that's who this is. And it's interesting, by the way, you bring, I think a Latino version of Fences would be a remarkable thing to do.
I think so.
I also know, I'm pretty sure August Wilson had said that he doesn't believe that any, like a white person should never direct any of his plays. He feels that they should be entirely done by African Americans because those are the only people that would, you know, understand that material.
Wow.
You know? But yeah.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
But okay. Yeah, no, it's funny. It's this is one of those areas where I think my respect for August Wilson was made real, real clear a couple of minutes ago. Yeah. And I also go like, man, I'd kind of like to see this Latino version of Fences. I think that might be a remarkable thing. You know,
might need 10 more years for me. Sterling Joe says, I watched that scene 4 times. It's amazing. Yes, it is. I mean, just the pounding of the chest moment, which as an actor watching another actor, the instinct to do that is fantastic. So not only are you watching the power of what he's doing, when you're watching it as an actor, you're watching the techniques, you're watching the decisions and the moments that are happening, both between him and Courtney B, because Courtney B is an essential part of that scene as well. You're watching the interactions and you're just fascinated at what both of them are able to find in just this snippet. And by the way, it wasn't during the course of the play. It was done in as a montage of scenes from plays that were nominated in the Tony Awards, because it ends with the, and that's Fences, dun, 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 so, which kills the whole mood of the scene. So the fact that they were able to capture that, even within that limited structure, I think is a fascinating commentary on them as well.
You know, John, the summer has been really, really hot. And my solution to it is to keep Fiji water on hand to keep my family and me hydrated and refreshed. It really is from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable, ancient artisan aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements.
Yeah, Stephen, doing research for Fiji water because I've really enjoyed the product and I like to find out more about the product. One of the things I discovered is as the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other top two premium bottled water brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring.
And this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water. And since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic. So you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office, which is where I have it right now. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
Let's move on to Star Wars. Because that's around this, right after we get, he has Claudine, which is a fantastic film that Cicely Tyson gets nominated for. He does get nominated for it, but certainly it's a film that's commentary about the Black experience in the 1970s. She's a woman with 6 kids who's going through 2 different failed relationships. He is one of those people involved in there. Oh, let me take this down. Sorry about that. And so that is another nice calling card for him film-wise at the time. And then in 1977, we hear him as Darth Vader. And by the way, let's talk about that real quick, Steve. He was paid, according to him and different reports here, anywhere between $7,000 and $9,000. That's it. He refused to get credit for the first 2 films. And the reason he gave is because Mercedes McCambridge was the voice of Blair when she was possessed by the demon in The Exorcist. And he saw that as special effects. She took credit, but he never thought that he should take credit for it. It wasn't until Return of the Jedi, then he saw how big this thing was, then he finally accepted credit. So a fascinating part of this thing. We talked about it in one of our intros that I'm sure he saw, look, David Prowse is doing the acting. I'm just doing the voiceover. It's not necessarily the same thing in his mind, but certainly had to come and accept that by the end there by Return of the Jedi.
I feel a little bit bad about something I had said when we did the intros, because I feel like I didn't give David Prowse enough credit for doing a great physical performance. I think it's funny. We were just talking. I remember when we did the Avengers and we were talking about the Hulk, and I just drew a blank on the actor's name because that's what I do all the time. The actor who played the Hulk in the Avengers.
Yeah.
Mark Ruffalo. This is why I can only do things if I have notes in front of me, because I will forget names right and left. So I remember that he said that he felt that he was in a partnership with the special effects team, that it was his performance and their performance. And I love the way he on. And that's what I think the reality is. I think the reality is that this is a team between the design of Darth Vader, which you can't discount. That design is huge. Yeah. The physical performance and the vocal performance. But there is no reality in which that vocal performance is just a special effect. Just Mercedes McCambridge is the same thing.
Yeah.
I think she deserves credit. I think what she does in that performance is amazing. And there's no, I mean, Darth Vader is, if you had had any other voice in the world, except possibly Orson Welles, who we already mentioned.
Yeah.
I don't think Star Wars works.
Oh, I agree. And I think it's so great that it happened back then, because you know what people would be saying? Like they're saying now, when does Pedro take off the mask? When does Pedro take off the helmet? When can I see his face in The Mandalorian? You would have had people, if this had come out now, the original trilogy, you'd have had people clamoring to see James Earl Jones's face under the mask. You'd have had that, but we didn't have that, right? And when they revealed it, as you mentioned in our intros, and it happened to be a white guy, it was a whole nother thing in terms of, but of course he was a white guy. So, I mean,
it has to be a white guy. Of course.
Exactly. But the situation there, though, I think it changed so many people's lives. I think there's millions upon millions upon millions of people who would not have been full Star Wars fans without Darth Vader. It's such an essential part of the Star Wars situation. And the fact they kept bringing him back in his later years to do some of the voiceover work for Darth Vader in certain projects speaks volumes to how resonant he is and how important he is to Star Wars as a character. And whoever is in the outfit is in the outfit. It's the voice that really is the big thing that sells Vader overall. No disrespect to David Prowse or anyone else who's worn the costume and done the physical parts of the performances, but it is the voiceover that does that thing at the end. And he did sign a contract that basically says Star Wars can recast this role whenever they feel like it. There is no need to, you know, pay homage to me or be beholden to me in any way, which I think is really magnanimous of him.
Well, he's a classy dude. I mean, that's, you know, having watched interviews with him now and read articles about him, this is a class. I mean, the fact that he refused credit. How many actors have you ever heard to refuse credit?
I know. I mean, it's that kind of thing. Like, he understands the purity of the craft. He understands the purity of the craft, and he is in service of the craft. And there's a special kind of respect for that. And I think that's where that comes from. I don't want to take credit for it. David is the one. David acted it out on the set. David is the physical body you see in all the films. I am just special effects, you know?
Well, I mean, you think about, again, it's the clip of, you know, and you mentioned him doing the Wolverine's promo for the team. I've watched now multiple of him doing top 10 show things on the David Letterman show. Right. I've seen, you know, Mike Vogel in your Geek Buddies episode talked about him doing the ABCs on Sesame Street. So I went and watched that. And my feeling is when he showed up to do Darth Vader, when he showed up to do This Is CNN, when he showed up to every single gig he ever showed up to, he showed up exactly the way he showed up to do Fences or Shakespeare in the Park or The Great White Hope or anything else. It was, I'm a pro and I'm going to give everything I have to whatever this is.
Yeah. Yeah. And deliver it as best I can. On the day. And it's funny you bring up Sesame Street, because he has an interesting relationship with Sesame Street. He participated in the test films that they used to promote Sesame Street. So before it was, he was essential in Sesame Street being greenlit, because he did these test films for Sesame Street in 1969. They are shorts. They do get combined with animated segments, and they were shown to groups of children to gauge the effectiveness of Sesame Street before they put them in production and made them. And then later when Sesame Street came out, those shorts were seen, and the ABCs, I think the ABC is part of that, things that he recorded ahead of time. Carol Burnett is the first celebrity to appear on Sesame Street, but James Earl Jones's recording of those segments predates Carol Burnett's appearance. So he is technically the first celebrity to have been involved in Sesame Street. He was also in the soap opera Guiding Light for a number of years as one of the rare black actors to appear in a soap opera that was massive at the time for him there. And so when you look at what he does with Star Wars, this is where things start to take off for him. The name starts to get known, right? And he plays Alex Haley, an older Alex Haley in Roots, the Next Generation. And then he moves into this real interesting segment of his life when he's the villain in Conan the Barbarian, as we said, Tulsa Doom, when he does Coming to America, when he does Madawan, which I think is another fantastic performance from James Earl Jones. If you haven't seen Madawan, that's an awesome John Sayles movie there that is based on the actual Battle of Madawan, which was a coal miner strike in 1920. One of those independent films that you need to watch from the 1980s. Then he does Coming to America in 1988 and Field of Dreams in 1989. And let's stop there before we get into the 90s and the Tom Clancy and the Lion King stuff. So the 80s is where you really start to understand who James Earl Jones is. He's becoming a household name. He's crossing over to the pop culture mainstream, obviously buoyed by Star Wars, but what a fascinating collection of films from the 1980s, playing all these different types of characters, yet no less effective in the work that they're doing in these films.
So first of all, there, just because you mentioned the early days of Sesame Street, there's a really good book on the history of Sesame Street called Street Gang that I'd highly recommend. The story, you know, between Jim Henson and what they're trying to do, and the dealing with the government and the going before Congress and all that stuff. The way Sesame Street got created is really, really interesting. Just on a side note, I can so remember, because obviously when Roots played on television in 1977, this was a big deal. And you know, sitting with my family watching that show was really a transformative thing. So when the sequel came along, by that point, I really knew who James Earl Jones was. Hmm. So when he shows up as Alex Haley, that's just like the perfect, like, of course, there can't be anybody else to play this part than him. And then, as you say, like the sort of rise of who he's going to be and culminating, you know, I think with, you know, of course he has to be the king in Coming to America, you know. And then, but you know, by the time obviously we're just re-releasing our episodes on both Coming to America and on Field of Dreams. Yeah. And, but you know, like I would say that James Earl Jones in Field of Dreams for me is akin to Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting, of just like this, the character, the actor that we adore coming in as the supporting role, as a supporting character who is the heart of the film. You know what I mean? Like, without, if you take James Earl Jones, I adore Field of Dreams top to bottom. But if you take James Earl Jones out of Field of Dreams, I don't know if it can succeed.
It works at all. He is essential. Again, he is essential. And this speaks to the genius of directors and creatives. They involved in these movies, they understand that James Earl Jones is essential for their movie. Right? I mean, I think Milius. And Milius who directed Conan, right?
Conan, yeah.
Yeah, getting James Earl Jones. I don't know how he got James Earl Jones and convinced him to play this role against a bodybuilder who was still making his name as an actor. I mean, the fact that he was willing to come in and bring this gravitas to that film is a coup. It is a coup that you were able to get James Earl Jones. And then when you see later on with Coming to America, with Field of Dreams, even with Madawan, these are directors who understand, like, we got to get James. The film doesn't work if we don't get James to play this role, because I think this role fits him perfectly. And you're 100% right. With Coming to America, the what he lends to the kingship, which we talked about in our intro, which is coming soon for you guys to listen to, radiates off the screen. But in Field of Dreams, it's so essential, as we said in our intro, to help help Ray Kinsella on his journey. We have to care about this guy so that when he does the monologue, which essentially blesses Ray for everything he's done, we have to be 100% on board with the character that he's created and portrayed. And as you so accurately pointed out, it is the small town scenes with him talking to the people, talking to the woman who's writing the obituaries. Those are those scenes that really help you to care about Terrence Mann, so that when he delivers the monologue, it's essential to making the movie, you know? And it's like a relief pitcher in baseball. He comes in and he closes out the innings to win the game. It is what he does there with that monologue, you know?
There are a few movies we've done on the Cinephiles where, I mean, there are old movies where we only did an hour where I want to redo them because we didn't really know what we were doing. We didn't do the full treatment at the time.
Sure.
Then there are other movies that I feel that we nailed, and I feel really proud of those Field of Dreams episodes, and I would still totally do it again today.
Yeah.
Like, that's how much I love that film. And I think if the subtleties in James Earl Jones's performance that you see from the guy who is intimidating and scary and defensive at the beginning to inquisitive and kind as he's in that small town and talking to the people, to childlike and joyful as he sees his heroes, to the full making that speech. And I can remember that what James Earl Jones said about that speech was that he knew that Phil Alden Robinson, the director, wanted him to preach it, like to make it a big preacher thing.
Yeah. Said,
and he went to him and said, look, I will do this, but I don't want to preach this.
Yeah.
It has to be simple. It has to be just honest. And man, what he does with that speech, because, you know, we're re-releasing it and I was listening to it again because when we did these new intros, of course, I wanted, you know, we talked about having a little clip of James Earl Jones at the beginning, and you knew I was going to use that clip. I mean, that, you know, I don't know if how often you can always predict which clip I'm going to pick at the beginning of our episodes, but there was no way I wasn't going to use People Will Come, Ray. And as I'm cutting it in, man, I still get teary-eyed. I put the YouTube clip on, I'll get teary-eyed, you know, because it's just so perfectly, contentedly, joyfully, honestly true.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, and I don't remember when he did This Is CNN, but I imagine this monologue is why he does CNN. This Is CNN.
It right? Feels, I feel like it's got to be right around the same time.
Right? Yeah, because the way he talks about America has been, you know, torn down and rebuilt again, the passing of time. Baseball marks the passing of time. The way in which he says that is fantastic. And, you know, Costner was on the Rich Eisen show. I watched this clip, and he was talking about the monologue. And this was a recent interview, by the way. I think it was to promote Horizon, and they asked him about the monologue, and he said, you know what's fascinating about that monologue is, like, James was never a baseball player. He was a basketball player, right? We are the I play baseball, you know, Phil, everybody, like these people, but it took him to speak, a non-athlete in essence, and because James was, you know, he didn't play baseball, it took him to capture our game in this monologue so accurately to understand baseball. He explained baseball for everybody. And that may be true, Steve, because, you know, I'm obviously was a sports fan. I don't know what your experience is with baseball. I think we've talked about it. Everyone's, you've gone to games and stuff like that, and you do enjoy that in San Francisco. But like what it was like for someone who has never played baseball, never had an interest in baseball, but who wanted to see this film or saw this film, and the way he explained it, I'd be so curious to hear what someone understood about baseball after they heard that monologue. Because it is, as Costner said, a perfect encapsulation of the importance of the game and the game itself in our history, our American history. You know.
Well, one interesting thing about that monologue that hadn't occurred to me until you were just speaking is it's not about someone playing baseball.
Right, no.
It's about someone, the going to baseball. It right. is about the joy, the childhood joy of seeing your heroes out on the field. He talks about you'll realize that there's a seat reserved for you, you know, on the first baseline or whatever he says. Right. That it's about that. And this is what's one of the dozens of remarkable things about Field of Dreams is that it is about America. It is about fathers and sons. It is about the pastoral world. It is about tradition. And so and this is where I also go to, like, well, there are all sorts of things. James Earl Jones actually never was a lion. He never has been a king. He never learned any things about the force. And yet he did all those things because it's acting, you know, is that he could embody. I mean, I don't think he was a boxer either, but he could embody that because he's an actor. And this is, you know, it's so funny. People, there's so many things that people misunderstand about acting. And one of them, I think, is that people think that there is a performance that happens without being a good reader. Actors have to be good readers. Mm-hmm. They have to understand the material. He has to read, you know, James Earl Jones had to read Shakespeare, and you have to understand the Shakespeare before you can deliver the Shakespeare. And I am sure with this, it's the same thing. He understood what every single word meant and researched it and thought about it and contemplated it. And that's what allows him to do that monologue.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And that's the thing, because it's not just about being an actor. It's about being good.
Yeah.
Being a good actor. And a good actor, as you said, will be able to help you experience what that character is experiencing. You know, I'm reminded of a very funny moment that on the Graham Norton show where he asked, I think it was Kate Winslet or one of these British actresses, like, do you come up, how do you cry? And how do you cry on command? And she said simply, the character is going through that, so that's what I'm doing. And so it was so matter of fact, because he was like, well, he saw it as, well, how do you spark this? How do you trigger the crying? Rather than, I'm an actor who has created this character. I've built the character from the ground up with the help of the writing, the help of the director, my acting teachers, my other fellow actors, from the ground up. So crying is actually easy for me to do, because that is what the character is supposed to do in that moment. And because the emotion, the life that I've given to this character is what you're seeing in that moment crying. It's not me triggering myself to cry. It is the actual character who is crying. God damn it. Who was it with? Oh, it was Emma Thompson. Kate Winslet. It was Emma Thompson who said that so matter of factly. And it stopped Graham cold and slightly embarrassed him. I could tell from his face. Because that's acting, right? People think it's a triggering of emotion. It's not. No. It's a construction from the ground up so that you can hit those emotions when the scenes call for them and live a moment-to-moment life, you know? And
So two things about this, and I know, you know, obviously we're talking about James Earl Jones, but this is, you know, he's one of our great actors, so talking about acting a little bit seems appropriate, is that the idea is like what that misunderstands is that the actor is on stage or in front of the camera, and at some moment they think to themselves, all right, in the next 10 seconds, I have to cry. So I got to get ready and get my crying going.
Right.
And the thing is, no human on earth goes, oh, I have to cry now. You most of the time, A, when people are crying, they're usually trying not to cry.
Right, exactly. You know?
Fighting against it. It's this thing that happens to them. And so by thinking, if an actor were to have the thought, in the next 30 seconds, I have to cry, they are not acting. They have left entirely the world of acting because they are not thinking the thoughts that their character is thinking.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. The second thing is, I cannot tell you how many times when I was teaching film school, I would have actors deliver a terrible performance and I would say, well, what does this line mean? And they would say, what do you mean? And I would say, why are you saying this line? And they would say, because it's the next line in the script. Or even I would say, what does this word mean? You said this word, like a big vocabulary kind of word. And they'd say, I don't know. There is no greater sin in my mind for an actor to be giving a performance and have words come out of their mouth that they actually don't understand.
Oh, yeah.
Like you can't do the acting. Like, you have to understand what the fucking words are. Otherwise, you can't. And they're just like, well, I'm supposed to be angry in this scene. I know that. So I'm just acting angry and saying these whatever these words that are on the page that I don't understand. That's not acting.
Yeah. Well, and that's why the great ones stand out, because they make you feel those emotions that are coming through. And I'm sure there are quite a few actors who are successful or famous who don't put that kind of work into the work they do, and they kind of look down on the profession. I mean, Hugh Grant was joking that right next to Emma Thompson, he's like, well, I have the lady come over and put stuff in my eyes. And so there are actors like that, right? And he gets away with it because he's a good looking white British dude from that time. But
Hugh Grant is good. I mean, like, he is a good actor.
Sure. But I would never put him in the category of Emma Thompson. I mean, I think
I agree.
A whole other ball. Or James Earl Jones, for God's sake.
Well, and to bring it back to James Earl Jones,
which is great.
No, yeah. But he totally wouldn't. Yeah. Going back to James Earl Jones, it's like, so the opposite of my acting students who don't actually know what they're saying is I too watched that monologue, the Shakespeare monologue that James Earl Jones delivered, is that if you want to deliver Shakespeare, it's not just that the actor has to understand that we're saying, they have to take this elevated and somewhat difficult language and be so clear on it in their mind that I, who do not speak in that language and are not educated on all that stuff, that I can understand every fucking word that comes out of their mouths. And with James Earl Jones doing that monologue, I was riveted. Every word, it was like he was speaking just normal English, even though he's speaking this elevated, beautiful, ancient, poetic English. Yeah,
that's what amazing. The great ones can do. Absolutely, man. Absolutely. And we head into the 90s now. We get the Tom Clancy series. You know, we did our intro for Hunt for Red October, which is out right now, that you guys could listen to our intro and listen to our episode on Hunt for Red October that's out on the Cinephiles YouTube channel, on this channel, and also on our podcast feed. He does the Admiral here in the Hunt for Red October Patriot Games He also goes into The Sandlot, which a lot of people kind of forget that he was a part of The Sandlot. Cry the Beloved Country in 1995. Also did Clear and Present Danger as part of that run there as Admiral Greer. And then, of course, Lion King, right? In 19, that's the 1994 animated film as Mufasa, which he is the only actor to come back and revoice the character that he did in the animated film in Jon Favreau's film. And it becomes a film. And he also did the sequel. It becomes a film that, or a performance rather, that is just massive for him at that time. Also in the 1990s, he's in the Treehouse of Horror with The Simpsons there as well. He also was a lead in three separate TV series. I think people forget this about James Earl Jones in the 1990s. Gabriel's Fire and a revamp version that was called Pros and Cons that aired on ABC in 1990 and 1992. In both of the formats, he plays a former policeman who's wrongly convicted of murder, who upon his release becomes a private eye. And then in 1995, he started another TV series, Under One Roof, who as a widowed African-American police officer sharing his home in Seattle with his daughter, his married son, and his children, and Neb's newly adopted son. It was a mid-season replacement that only lasted 6 weeks, but he did get an Emmy nomination off of that. So didn't find as much success on television as a lead in any of these shows, but appeared in a number of shows, Steve, where people remember his performances. But let's deal with the 90s in terms of the movies. All the Admiral Greer stuff, all the Tom Clancy films, including Hunt for Red October, but also The Sandlot, Lion King, and what else? Oh, Cry the Beloved Country, if you've seen that as well. And yeah, but what are your thoughts on him in the 90s here?
So first of all, Cry the Beloved Country is a beautiful film based on a beautiful and powerful book. I was just going like, just as I was saying, like, how many people can we put in that vocal league with James Earl Jones?
Yeah.
But I also go, man, he is a critical cultural touchstone for multiple generations in multiple different ways.
Yep.
Like just being Darth Vader alone is a critical touchstone for people, particularly a little bit younger than me. There's nothing like Mufasa, you know, like Mufasa is a critical touchdown. And for every father and son in particular, but everyone who grew up with baseball, Terrence Mann and Field of Dreams is a touchstone. Like these are characters. And to some degree, I'd say Coming to America as well. You know, it's like these are, and just to go back to Mufasa, it's like, because we have King Joffrey and Eddie Murphy, daddy issues. We have Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. We got some daddy issues, you know. And here, Mufasa is the great father that we all wanted, you know.
Yeah.
The one who believes in us and is honest and pure and good. In fact, the one that is so good that, in fact, that's part of Simba's problem at the beginning of the movie is that the distance between him and Mufasa, you know.
Yeah.
Like, he just wants to be king and doesn't understand the greatness of the person that has to hold that role. You know, he has to figure out how to live up. It's like, so Luke Skywalker has to redeem his father. Eddie Murphy has to rebel from his father, and Simba has to figure out how to live up to his father.
Yeah. Yeah. Like we said earlier, a lot of father son issues in the choices of roles that he makes, which I thought are fantastic. And what you just highlighted is I think I said in one of the intros, you know, the original trilogy could be your entry point. Mufasa is your entry point. Any of the other big roles that he's done could be your entry point into James Earl Jones, because not everyone is a Star Wars fan. Not everyone is an animated movie fan. Not everyone is a comedy fan. So it's just a matter of it. But he was able to cover them all. And I would add another father figure to what you're talking about. I think Admiral Greer is absolutely a father figure to Jack Ryan, which I think you alluded to one of our intros, that he's the person that, like, is the ones giving him counsel, is the one making him feel better about this stuff, is the one who is helping him. I rewatched the scene that's in that clip thing where he is dying and he is there saying, you know, you gave your word to the people, to the president's boss, which is the American people. So even in that dilapidated state, for lack of a better term, he is able to deliver a powerful and resonant commentary and piece of advice to Jack Ryan that helps him in that situation, you know?
Yeah, I'm really, it's so funny. There aren't that many actors who I go, boy, I wish I could have really worked with that guy. Like, wouldn't that have been amazing to have been able to direct James Earl Jones, to be able to to write something and have James Earl Jones say words that I wrote. I mean, that would be just an honor, you know.
I agree. You know, who was I just thinking? Oh, Annalee Ashford, who is one of the most amazing actresses working today in musical theater and on film occasionally and on TV. She worked with James Earl Jones near the end of his life and spoke about that experience of working with him and what a career highlight it was for her to be in a stage play with James Earl Jones. You know, she's a fantastic actress. Other things that happened in the 90s here for James Earl Jones. He spoke the U.S. national anthem before the 1993 Major League Baseball All-Star Game in Baltimore, accompanied by the Morgan State University Choir. Then he recited Casey at the Bat with the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra in 1996, then did it again in 2007 before Philadelphia Phillies home game. So there's some fun things that happened during his time in the 90s. Going in the 2000s is where he really starts to become like this great surprise guest appearance on TV shows like Law & Order and Frasier, Lois and Clark, House MD, The Big Bang Theory, Two and a Half Men. It's also in the 2000s where he receives the Kennedy Center's honor at the John F. Kennedy Center in D.C. with Paul Simon, Elizabeth Taylor, Cheetah Rivera. And President George W. Bush at the time said, "People say that the voice of the president is the most easily recognized voice in America. Well, I'm not going to make that claim in the presence of James Earl Jones tonight." He was also there to honor Jones. Sidney Poitier, if you haven't seen Sidney Poitier's speech about James Earl Jones, the Kennedy Center honors, do yourself a favor. They are contemporaries in a lot of ways as two black men making it through the world of acting in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and what have you. Kelsey Grammer, Charles S. Dutton, and Courtney B. Vance all offer tributes to James Earl Jones at the time, and then becomes the voice of CNN there and lent his voice to the opening for NBC's coverage of the 2000 and 2004 Summer Olympics. Then he narrated all 27 books of the New Testament in an audiobook. James Earl Jones reads the New Testament. Pretty simple title. So you can pick that up and listen to him. If any of you love the New Testament or are religious, I think there's probably a whole new way to experience the New Testament with James Earl Jones reading it. But Steve, do you remember any of his appearances here on any of these TV shows throughout this? I mean, he played himself in The Big Bang Theory and went after Carrie Fisher, which is a really funny moment. Any remembrances there?
I've seen the clips from the Carrie Fisher ones, which are hilarious. And the giddy, joyful glee of James Earl Jones in those is just, because seeing him being childlike and silly, it's like him walking into the corn in Field of Dreams, but taken to a whole other level. I do remember seeing him in House. I don't think I've seen some of the other ones. Just like you, I watched those speeches at the Kennedy Center Honors. Yeah. By the way, I mean, getting a Kennedy Center Honor of all of them up to the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
Other than that, or, you know, the Kennedy said that is quite an accomplishment in his career. And I think, you know, I don't have plans on listening to the New Testament anytime soon, but I have read the book. If I were to go back and do it again, I will be getting James Earl Jones's version. There's no question about that.
I would encourage people to find the because I think it did two episodes of Law & Order, but the one episode of Law & Order that I went back and rewatched, because I love Law & Order, it went back and rewatched, he plays an attorney for a white supremacist. It is a fascinating episode because he's going up against Michael Moriarty there and Joe Hennessy, and they're both just absolutely gobsmacked that this notable black lawyer is defending a white supremacist who comes from a rich family in a situation where he is shot and tried to kill Joe Seneca. Who's Joe Seneca? Why, he's a special doctor in the verdict of what we're talking about. So he is a doctor there as well, and says that he's 74 years old in this one as well, which is fascinating. But no, but the thing about that episode that's also is fascinating is not just that a black man is representing a white man in a racially motivated killing. It is that he is saying, when Ben tries to call him out on this, he says to him, "How come you never quizzed any of the white men for defending defending black people for shooting white people in crimes? How come you didn't have an issue when it was the reverse of the situation?" And it's a fascinating thing. So it's one of the best episodes of Law & Order that's early on in their run. The Big Bang Theory stuff is very funny. And for those who don't know, he had never met Carrie Fisher until he did that Big Bang Theory episode. And that was the first time they'd ever met. The creator of the show said that in an interview. and said that when Carrie walked up to him and saw him for the first time, she just smiled and said, "Dad," and they had a big massive hug between them. But he was so great to pop in on these shows, man. It was so much fun to see him and see what he was doing. But then he went back to plays. You know, he went back to doing stuff in the theater. He was with Leslie Uggams when they did an African-American version in 2005 of On Golden Pawn. And then in 2008, he starred as Big Daddy in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, a Tennessee Williams.
It must have been great.
Right? Directed by Debbie Allen, that was staged at the Broadhurst Theater. He reprised it in London in 2009 on the London's West End with Sanaa Lathan as Maggie, who some of you may know from numerous films like Love and Basketball. Felicia Rashad played Big Mama, and Adrian Lester played Brick in that. And then in the later 2000s, he did the Morgan Freeman role in Driving Miss Daisy on stage with Vanessa Redgrave. So coming back together with Vanessa Redgrave to play that. And then later in London's West End, he did it with Angela Lansbury and took that around, and then did Much Ado About Nothing. As I mentioned, the Annalee Ashford, it was You Can't Take It With You, which she received a Tony Award nomination for that. Then with him and Malcolm McDowell, did a series of commercials for Sprint, which I don't
remember that
at all. Yeah. And so I want to go back and watch those. And of course, then went back to reprise Darth Vader in Rebels, Rogue One, Rise of Skywalker, and as I said, Lion King there. And then in Coming to America, which was his last screen role, Coming to America, the sequel, that was the last time he ever appeared on screen in anything. So an interesting run towards the end, but clearly defaulting back to the stage, which I would argue for a man who's gotten older seems to ask more of your body and more of your time and more of your attention. But maybe he sensed that this, he had done enough, he was rich enough, he was comfortable enough that he wanted to go back to the thing that he loved the most, which seemed to be performing on stage, brother.
I mean, it seems like it's his first love. And right. You know, I mean, as an actor, you know that the stage, the theater, is an actor's medium. Like, you know, work with a director, but then once you're up, it's your show, and you are there gauging the audience, connecting with them. It's your timing, it's your choices. That is, and I'll tell you, I saw Angela Lansbury in Blythe Spirit, and I think she was 94 or something.
Wow.
I mean, this was not that long ago. You know, not pretty close to her death, and man, she killed it. Like, there are a bunch of actors who just like, no, this is 6 days a week. I go out and I get up on the stage, and this is where I get my life and energy from, you know.
Yeah. Jennifer Lewis in the comments here in chat says, I saw James Earl Jones and Angela Lansbury on Broadway and Gore Vidal's best man. So wow, that's awesome to have seen him. I'm jealous of you and other people who have seen him on stage, as I never had a chance to see him on stage, but just fantastic stuff to see him coming back to do that, which brought him so much joy, you know. And I think it was great. And guys, you do yourself a disservice if you love James Earl Jones and you don't go back and watch a number of his interviews on YouTube, on the Dick Cavett Show in the 1970s with Charlie Rose. There are he did a lot of interviews for smaller stations, which were fantastic. So there's so much to explore. I've been spending all week just going in on YouTube wormholes and watching his conversations in these interviews. And as Steve said earlier, this is an incredibly intelligent person and a fascinating man to watch, and then watch the progression of his opinions through these interviews about what's going on in the world and in acting and in the entertainment business as he gets older. It's really an experience there as well. You know what's fascinating about him personally, though, Steve? The two women he married in his life both played Desdemona to his Othello at different times in their careers. Yes, his first wife, Julianne Moore, whom he met in 1964 when she was Desdemona to his Othello. They divorced in 1972, and then in 1982, he married actress Celia Hart, who had played Desdemona to his Othello shortly after they wed, and they had a son there, Flynn Jones, there. But as I mentioned earlier, James Earl Jones was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in the 1990s, only spoke about it in 2016 and talked about it. And you know how he found out about it? He fell asleep while he was exercising at the gym. And that's what kind of sparked him. So a man who overcame so many things, dealt with so many things, but left an incredible legacy. And as I said, there's so much to explore about him beyond what Steve and I can do, beyond what any articles you can read. do your own research. You know, one of our great listeners and a personal friend of mine, Mike Shea, who loves the show, listens to our show, he texted me today to tell me how much he's loving our intros and that he didn't know how much he was affected by the loss of James Earl Jones until he sat down and thought about it this week and really understood how important this man was to his life. He is such a constant, Steve, for so many decades. Yeah. I imagine a lot of people had that experience. I know I did this week. It's fascinating, you know?
I think because for the most part, with the exception of things like The Great White Hope, he's been a supporting actor. I won't say that we've overlooked him, but I think until him passing, I literally, same experience where I was like, he's so much a part of so many pieces of my life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the fact that it's so lovely when there's someone you admire and then you look into them and you go, no, I was right to admire this person.
Yeah.
They're a great person. I mean great in every sense. Great. This is a great actor. Great in the sense that they're a great human being. Mm. Great in the sense that they've achieved greatness by overcoming adversity. I mean, this is a great person, you know?
100%. And we just scratched the surface in over an hour of conversation about him. Let's hit some of these Streamlabs real quick, Steve, as we're getting close to wrapping up. Sterling Jones says, from Vader to Amazing Monologues to This Is CNN, to him reciting the alphabet on Sesame Street, etc. Such an amazing career. RIP to Mr. Jones. Absolutely.
Couldn't agree more, Sterling.
JMB says, if you were to introduce the Dark Lord of the Jones to a person completely unfamiliar with... If you were to introduce the Dark Lord of the Jones to a person completely unfamiliar with him, what would you start with? Handicap, no Star Wars, Lion King, or Field of Dreams? Well, you know, I think Steve and I said it earlier. I think A Great White Hope. That's the...
Totally, 100%.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then maybe Madawan after that, I would say. Fantastic314 says, hey, cinephiles, James Earl Jones carries a regal tone to his acting. His presence is massive and casts a shadow over his counterparts, even Murphy or Costner. Best of the best. Oh, is my favorite James Earl Jones movie. Steve, what's your memory of James Earl Jones in Best of the Best, man?
So I saw this when it came through on the comments. I've been waiting for it to come up this whole time. Everyone who's a fan of the cinephiles probably knows that for a good portion of my life in college, I hunted down every martial arts movie I could ever find. I probably watched Best of the Best at least 15 times.
Yeah.
So Best of the Best, first of all, for that era of American martial arts films, has really good fight scenes.
Yes.
Second of all,
yes,
James Earl Jones, it's like we've said throughout this whole thing. He didn't come in and say, I'm doing a stupid martial arts movie. He came in and said, I have a job. And I'm going to take it as he's fantastic in the movie.
Yes, he is, man.
He's totally great. He completely sells that film. I actually was thinking after seeing this and thinking about it, I'm like, maybe I'm going to watch Best of the Best again.
Why not?
Falls in as a guilty pleasure. Yes, I think it's probably I might say that it is in the top. I think it's in the, is it in the 80s or 90s?
It's 80s.
It is in the 80s. It is in the top five American martial arts films of the 80s.
Wow. Well, of the
80s. That's not a very high standard.
American, right? Gymkhana. You have to move out Gymkhana to make room for it, I think.
It is a better film than Gymkhana by far.
Yeah, it's 1989. Eric Roberts, Sally Kirkland, Christopher Penn, Philip Rhee. Philip Rhee's great.
A genuinely great martial artist.
Agreed. So yeah, it's and Louise Fletcher of all people is in this movie.
Oh,
so
Jesus.
Fascinating. So yeah, if you haven't seen Best of the Best, do yourself a favor. Because I think what Steve said is absolutely accurate. He commits, you know, that's what's great about him. And there is no kind of like arrogance to him, to whatever he's in. And clearly he has always had this kind of joy to play characters in films like this, like he did in Conan, I would argue. Best of the Best, like it's in that realm of Conan, even though Conan is of course one of the great ones, but you can't ignore the fact that that's a B movie. So it fits in the realm of the fact that he doesn't take anything like this stuff too serious. He isn't arrogant about it. And I think that's great. When you look at James Earl Jones,
I was listening recently to an interview with Michael Caine, I think it was, and who, you know, obviously someone who took a lot of movies.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And I think it was Terry Gross was saying like, well, how do you choose it? And he's like, well, I choose, where are we going to shoot? What's the food going to be like? Do I have something fun to do? It's not necessarily, you don't go just like, I must only do great films. It's like, well, where am I going to, if, you know, acting is fun. Yeah. I'm sure playing that part in Best of the Best was a ball.
Yeah.
You know, you got nice. If the people are nice, which maybe Eric Roberts, maybe in that era, not so nice, but whatever, you know, if the people are nice and it's fun to do, it'll be fun. It's fine.
Yeah. 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 Elder Geek says, if I were to compare my late father to a Disney character, Mufasa would be the closest.
Wow.
That's strong.
You're a lucky person. Yeah. Lucky person to have Mufasa as a father.
That's true. All right. Sit some of these Streamlabs as well. Adam McAllister. Thank you, Adam. He says, hey, guys, when seeing his filmography, I had no idea that his feature film debut was in Dr. Strangelove. What is a film that everyone that should see of his that doesn't get a lot of love? Thanks and see you at the advisory board meeting. Yeah, we've hit Great White Hope, but are there other smaller gems, Steve? I mean, we just talked about Best of the Best, which could have qualified, but is there anything else that you would think to recommend to somebody that's maybe a little hidden gem in James Earl Jones's career as an actor?
I'll tell you a movie I've really wanted to revisit. It's one I watched many times for a certain period. I haven't seen it probably in 15 or 20 years. He's only in it for a couple of minutes at the end, but that's Sneakers.
Oh, yes.
I always love Sneakers. I think it is definitely, for me, falls into the category of a hidden gem.
Yeah, I've talked about, well, on the intros, I talked about A Family Thing, which I love. If you guys haven't seen this film, it's from the early 2000s. It's him and Robert Duvall, and they find out that their mom was black, and both of them didn't even know they existed. They don't know, and they're older men. They had no idea they had a brother. They had no idea they were separated at birth, and they find this out, and they both have to go on this journey of come to terms with it. Robert Duvall has kind of a slightly racist white family, and James Earl Jones has a slightly racist black family towards white people. So they're both having to come this journey and then bring their families along on this journey, which is a fascinating film for people to explore. But I'll throw a couple more out there. And I already mentioned Matawan. Matawan's another one that people should. But I think Gardens of Stone, which is kind of an unrecognized 1980s film people don't talk about anymore. He's fantastic in that film and what he does in that film and what he brings to the table in that film in adding that kind of resonance to the role he plays in that movie that I would recommend highly to people. And I would say, and this, some people, I know this film is like kind of persona non grata now, but if you haven't seen Soul Man, and I know it's blackface and all that kind of stuff, but James Earl Jones's character in that film, when he has these conversations with C. Thomas Howell and the idea of the black experience and all of that, and Ray Don Chong, this is interesting. Like, this is a great performance within a film that is obviously problematic now, which probably Steve auditioned for using the August Wilson monologue. No, I'm joking. But like, it would be funny.
It's true.
What for people to go and see this? Because I think he's so good in the movie. Do you remember Soul Man? Do you remember him in the movie?
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, this is, so here's what I said. I think this movie is totally problematic in a myriad of ways. But it also is a movie that was trying to address certain things.
Yeah.
And maybe it didn't do that as well as possible. And I think we can say what we've said from the beginning. Did James Earl Jones show up for a paycheck and phone it in? No. James Earl Jones did what he always does, which is to deliver what he needed to deliver for that role.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll throw one out there that I don't think either of you have ever seen. Either of us have ever seen, Steve, but maybe you have. The Bushido Blade. Have you ever seen this film?
The Bushido Blade, the documentary?
No, no. There's a film called The Bushido Blade, which is directed by Sogonoba Kotani, and it stars Toshiro Mifune and Richard Boone, of all people. Richard Boone's a great Western actor. James Earl Jones is in it as the prisoner, and Mako from Conan. No,
I have seen this.
You have?
I've seen this. The memory is slim, but because like I said, I went out to find every weird random martial arts film I could. Yeah. I definitely see it. And Mako, I mean, like anything that Mako was in, I was all about. I always loved him. I know. I did see it. I don't remember it quite as well as, because there's also the Toshiro Mifune and maybe where it's the Western. There's the Toshiro Mifune. There's Hell in the Pacific, which is Toshiro Mifune and I think Lee Marvin. Oh, it's Charles Bronson and Toshiro Mifune is the Western.
Yeah,
yes, I've definitely seen them.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that because it's on the train. It's on the train.
Yes,
right. Yes, I remember that because it's about the blade. They're trying to get that blade. Yeah, so there you go. So there's some ones you can toss in there to expose people to. And I know Martin Lawrence retweeted out the scene he had with James Earl Jones, who played his dad in Welcome Home, Roscoe Jenkins. And it was a pretty fantastic scene. So again, father-son type of situation going on there as well. All right, let me see what else we got here. Thank you, Adam, for that. Very kind of you. Hoth security guard says, as an elder millennial, James Earl Jones's passing reminded me of Robin Williams. That's something you said, Steve. I thought of their voice work first, Genie and now Vader and Mufasa. The adult and the 10-year-old version of me is sad. Ethics aside, I'm still 50-50 that Jones approved his voice to be used for Vader. I'm happy I could potentially hear him as Vader again, but other people have voiced Bugs Bunny after Mel Blanc, and I want Jones's Vader to be limited and special to what he did. And that's the what he's referencing is what James Earl Jones signed a contract. He authorized archival recordings of his voice to be used in the future to artificially generate the voice of Darth Vader. In September of 2022, Jones announced that he would retire from the role of voicing Darth Vader, with future voice roles for Vader being created by that means. So he was fine with it being artificially altered down the road. So we'll see in the end if other people voice it and if they adhere to it. It all depends on what the public is okay with and not okay with. But, you know, James did what he did. What do you think of these comments here from Hoth security guard, Steve?
It's weird. I mean, we're entering into literally a strange new world.
Yeah.
Because we have two alternatives here. Darth Vader is James Earl Jones's voice. That's, you know, that is written in stone in my soul.
Yes.
So the two alternatives is that someone else, possibly an incredible actor with an incredible voice, will come in and create their own version of Darth Vader, which is what we've done with a myriad of characters throughout history. Yeah. And that's fine. And that's the way it's always been.
Right.
Or we will continue to hear James Earl Jones's voice saying words he never said, created by artificial intelligence. And my guess is that, knowing what I understand about AI, is that it's going to get better and better and better, and it'll sound really good. And I'm sure James Earl Jones's family is going to continue to make money off of that and something in the contract. And it'll just sound like Darth Vader. And I am uncomfortable with both of these alternatives, and I don't know how I feel. How do you feel?
I feel like, look, here's the deal. You know, we got to come to terms with the situation. If you want to stand and complain and get upset about it, you have every right to do it, but it's not going to matter. It is coming, and it is not changing. Yeah. We have to come to terms with it. Studios are not listening to people and any kind of protest or standing on the sideline with a sign is not going to make a difference. They're going to find a way. What are we seeing now? The business itself is constricting. Why? Because of the strikes, because people want more money. The studio is like, okay, we're going to find new and cheaper ways in order to make these movies that limit the creative input of creators, limit the amount of time creators spend, limit what we have to pay them. It's the harsh, honest truth. What are you going to do? You can't force people to do certain things. So you've got to figure out how to work within the parameters as they change. And I think Steve's 100% right. We're in uncharted territory right now. And so how this all plays out is going to be fascinating to watch as we go forward. But no one has owned a role like James Earl Jones has owned Darth Vader. And so if he wants to sign off in that situation, then guess what? He has every right to do it.
Totally. I agree.
Yeah, it's always in the creator. I may hate all of George Lucas's extra scenes or deleted scenes in the original trilogy, or how he changed who shot first. Guess what? He made it. So you can have an opinion about it, but it doesn't matter to the creator. The creator gets a right to do with it what he pleases. You don't own it. They do. And that's the way I've always felt about the situation. You know, I'm a big believer in that. By the way, the Robin Williams, James Earl Jones thing is funny, because one of the final films that Robin Williams did before he took his life was The Angriest Man in Brooklyn, directed by Field of Dreams' Phil Alden Robinson.
Oh, interesting.
James Earl Jones comes in to play a small role as a store owner selling Robin Williams' angry character at the time, a camcorder. And James Earl Jones does his stutter. And it's an incredible scene. It's an incredible scene with a great button at the end. But to watch his stutter, now this is a guy who actually stuttered. To see his interpretation of stuttering in that scene is fascinating. It is compelling, heartbreaking, yet also played near the end for humor. And I think that was such an interesting approach to that character. Not the best of movies, but I thought that scene worked really well. So if you want to experience another great scene with James Earl Jones, and the late, great Robin Williams is there as well. Wayne Edwards sent us something here, Steve. Thank you, Wayne. James Earl Jones was also in a couple of episodes of Homicide: Life on the Streets. James Earl Jones and Andre Brower together is an acting masterclass. Great job, guys. Steve, Homicide is on Peacock now. They've remastered them to HD. I am introducing this to my significant other, Lindley. We just finished season one. We're moving into season two, and I can't wait to get to the James Earl Jones, which are probably season five, I think, or season six. Did you watch Homicide: Life on the Street? Do you have any experience, your memory of James Earl Jones in that show?
I didn't watch it.
Ooh.
Yes, it's funny because it's come up multiple times, and I've been meaning to tell you because I know that I you'll be disappointed in me, and yes, I haven't. But as soon as I saw, and that, it's funny because I was just listening again. I think it was on Fresh Air. They had a bunch of interviews with the creators and, you know, posthumous interviews with Andre Brower about Homicide, and I'm like, you know what? I think I'm gonna start from the beginning. So maybe I'll try to catch up to you and Lindley. I know I will love it. Everything I've heard about it is it's one of the great shows. I cannot wait. And so, yeah, I'm going to get to it.
The first episode is an interesting pilot, but then it hits its stride and you're good to go. And the first season's only like 10 episodes. The second season's only like 4 episodes, which features Robin Williams in the opening season of season two, whose wife has been murdered. And the whole episode is about what he does in reaction to it with the cops trying to find out who did it. Fascinating. And then we jump into the big, longer seasons of 3, 4, 5, and 6, I think. So yeah, fascinating stuff. Highly recommended. And from there, you can jump into The Wire. Same creator, same style, same approach. If you haven't seen The Wire, that's another one.
I have seen The Wire.
So you'll see some of the bones of The Wire. You'll see some of the fleshed out stuff of The Wire and the bones of it in Homicide for sure. All right. Anything more, Steve, we should talk about here? We're hitting that 90-minute mark where we usually wrap up. So final words, I think, on James Earl Jones here as we say goodbye, or anything we didn't cover or didn't talk about that you want to make sure we add here in this episode?
No, I don't think I have anything to add. It's just there aren't a lot of actors for whom my love is unconditional. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there are incredible actors that I probably wouldn't want to hang out with all the time. There are actors who had eras where they gave amazing performances and then maybe eras not so much. That's not true of James Earl Jones. There are actors who within a certain genre, they're amazing, but not so much in others. That's not true of James Earl Jones. There are actors with big egos. That doesn't seem to be true of him. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's an actor who literally has been with me my whole life, you know, and I'm telling you, the fact that the same guy is Darth Vader and Jack Jeffries in The Great White Hope, which I'm going to say for the fifth or how many times you and I said it, for those of you watching or listening right now, this is a movie you need to seek out. And I would recommend watching the very average transfer that's on YouTube to see this astounding performance. But then having this transformative moment in the theater, like a life-changing moment in the theater, watching James Earl Jones on stage in Fences, and then all of these other movies, and in particular, nothing will ever touch me more deeply than his performance in Field of Dreams. Like it is just, and so I'm really, really sad that we've lost him. And I'm really thrilled that we're here in this moment to celebrate what is the life of an incredible artist.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as much as we spent almost 90 minutes talking about him, I still believe we haven't done him justice. I don't know that there's any montage, any kind of tribute that would ever do him full justice. But that just speaks to the breadth of decades of his work. And as Steve just highlighted, the numerous genres, the numerous types of films, the numerous types of characters, the numerous places he explored behind a mic, in front of a camera, on a stage. He was there for all of us from if you were a kid growing up in Sesame Street to Star Wars to The Lion King to Coming to America and Field of Dreams, to into the 2000s and what he did in the 2000s, to bringing Vader back for a lot of us and probably introducing Vader for a lot of people who became Star Wars fans later, introducing Darth Vader in a different way as a later character. It's a fascinating, fascinating career. And I think there's a lot to be gleaned from his performances that spoke to his points of views on the world, his points of views as a black man in the world, and his points of views on acting and performing in the world, not only as a black actor, but an actor itself. You can glean so much of his opinions on that when you see his movies. And as we highlighted, an actor who didn't take himself too seriously. Yeah. One of the great quotes he has near the end when they were asking him about acting, and he just says, "I'm still a novice even at this advanced age." And that just tells you, for those of us who are artists or have been artists or are creatives, like when you hear someone who's so willing, who's so great at what they do, but is still so willing to be in service of the work, that's an actor to admire. That's a creative person to admire and aspire to be in your life. And so many of us never get there, but we can certainly aspire to get there. And that's what I think he symbolizes at his core at the end of the day, you know, a shining light to aspire to be in all ways as a performer and as a human being. So, all right, well, there you go. That's our tribute remembrances for James Earl Jones. Thanks to everybody who hung out with us today. Thanks for the Streamlabs and the Super Chats. We appreciate it madly. To everybody who's going to listen to us, who listens to this episode as well, thank you so much. Steve, what do we have to tell the wonderful people who listen to our show or watch our show?
Well, I can tell them that right now we are in the middle of exploring the worlds of Robert Redford and Paul Newman. We did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, followed by The Sting. And now John and I just yesterday, I think, recorded our first part of The Verdict. And I'm just going to let you all have a little preview. This is a fantastic conversation about an absolutely phenomenal movie. So we're working on that right now. That's going to come out this Friday. And of course, if you want to support the show, you can do it at patreon.com/thecinephiles, where you can hear ad-free versions of the show, our Cinephiles shorts. You can join our advisory board and help plot the future of the Cinephiles. You can also get ad-free versions of the show or there are shorts via Apple Podcasts. And that's just for $4.99 a month. It's a great way to sign up and help support the show. You can buy or stream any movie we've ever reviewed on cinephiles.net. And if you want to reach me, it's SR Morris on Twitter and SR Morris 1 on Instagram. John, how about you?
As for me, it's at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, The Outlaw Nation on Twitch. And for those of you who are listening to us, we have so many great sponsors of our shows, and they, you know, can listen to it when you listen to the podcast feed of our show. If you can't support us in other ways, you can, if there are products that we talk about on the show or that there are advertising on our show, a great way to support us is to use our code for those products and tell them that you heard of us, you heard of them through us. That's another way you can help support the show. We'd appreciate you all doing that. Please make sure you hit a like on this video. Leave your comments about James Earl Jones and anything we said down in the comment section below. And leave a like as well and share this with any of the people you follow or any of your social media so the people who follow you can take a chance on the Cinephiles and we can keep growing this massive community that we have more and more every day. So thank you so much for joining us. You guys are awesome. And we'll talk to you next time, next month, with another brand new live episode here on the Cinephiles. Peace until then.